This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters. Our guest this morning is Seth Dunn, Research Associate at World Watch Institute. Seth was previously a guest on the sustainability segment in December of 2000 when he told us about Iceland's plan to end reliance on fossil fuel and become the world's first hydrogen economy. He is here today to give us an update on how far we have come in moving towards a hydrogen economy and to discuss how the events of September 11th could lead to a reconsideration of our energy priorities. Welcome, Seth.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's good to have you back. Could you start by giving our listeners a brief review of how hydrogen can be used as a fuel and the environmental advantages of hydrogen over fossil fuel as an energy source?
Sure. Hydrogen can be, first, it can be derived from a number of different sources. It's the lightest, most abundant element in the universe. It can be extracted from hydrocarbons like oil or natural gas. It can be derived through electrolysis, which is the splitting of water with electricity. So there are a number of ways in which the hydrogen can be separated and then used either directly in liquid form or and the more promising alternative is to use it in what's called a fuel cell, which is sort of like a battery, but what it does is combine hydrogen and oxygen to generate electricity and water. So it has very few byproducts. And, of course, if you're deriving the hydrogen from fossil fuels, there are some emissions. But generally speaking, because of the efficiency, you are talking about an improvement over, for example, a coal-fired power plant or a gasoline internal combustion engine.
Where does most of the hydrogen that's currently being used come from?
Most of it does come from natural gas through a process called steam methane reforming. And that hydrogen is usually used on site for everything from petroleum refining to the manufacture of ammonia, a number of resins and solvents. So it is, to some extent, already produced commercially for industrial commodities. Now, of course, the challenge for producing it as a major energy source is significant and will require a lot of improvements in both the steam reforming process and in other kinds of processes down the line. Like, for example, if we want to derive hydrogen ultimately from renewable energy such as solar or wind power, a lot of improvements in the efficiency of that process need to happen.
In the long term, what do you think is the best source of hydrogen?
Well, what's interesting, you know, over the last year in talking with people from industry, what's encouraging is that many of the fuel companies, such as Shell or Ford, they see the ultimate source for hydrogen being renewable energy, such as solar or wind power. In the near term, however, many of them see natural gas as a likely bridge fuel. You can use many pipelines that use natural gas also to accommodate hydrogen. But also, a number of companies are also looking at ways to reform methanol or gasoline in the near term and using those fuels in fuel cell cars.
How much hydrogen is currently being used?
Well, it's about the equivalent of about 3 to 4% of global oil production. So it's a pretty small amount. So it's a small scale to begin with. However, there's growing demand for industrial uses, and of course, as fuel cells approach mass production, which they haven't reached yet, but as they do both for cars and for stationary uses, you will probably see hydrogen fuel companies begin to expand their facilities to get ready for this new source of demand.
Well, I think we all know the problems with fossil fuel and global warming and pollution, but could you expand on the environmental impacts of hydrogen production? We've been told it's much better, but are there environmental impacts of hydrogen production as well?
Certainly. As with every form of energy production, there are going to be impacts, and scientists call these life cycle impacts. So there's definitely an opportunity and a need to look at the life cycle impacts in terms of energy use and environmental impact to reduce that as much as possible. And it's not just how much comes out of the fuel cell. It's also what all the different stages. So in that, beginning with the construction of a wind power plant, if you're going to use wind power to split water and provide the hydrogen. So really, and again, across all those different stages, from the production to the transmission, to the storage and to the use, there are major impacts. But I think probably the most interesting and issue and source of debate right now is what's known as the well-to-wheels effects of different sources. For example, asking the question, what's better environmentally? Should we use natural gas and then reform the natural gas into hydrogen and use it directly on the car, or should we use gasoline and store it on the car and then use a mini reformer on the car to provide the hydrogen? From that perspective, it's clear that finding a way to store the hydrogen directly on a car through better tanks or other kinds of new technologies such as hydrides or nanotubes, that's ultimately the better approach in terms of overall emissions. It's much greater improvement over the internal combustion engine than if you were to reform to gasoline or methanol. Now, that's a challenge because many car companies tend to feel that it probably makes more sense just to use the existing infrastructure for gasoline and then get the hydrogen right at the end of the cycle. But in terms of the overall environmental emissions, the best way to go is direct hydrogen. But the challenge is persuading the industry that that's the way to go.
Looking again at hydrogen versus fossil fuel, are there any good calculations about how much of a fold improvement it would be to go to a hydrogen as an energy source, say coming from renewable energy such as solar or wind, compared to fossil fuel?
Well, there haven't been many detailed studies, but Shell has just come out with an interesting new set of scenarios, and they look at sort of a business-as-usual scenario, which is sort of a gradual trend toward renewable energy and cleaner fossil fuels, and then a more revolutionary move toward a true hydrogen economy. And they conclude that moving aggressively toward a true hydrogen economy by the early latter part of this century could achieve could limit the increase in carbon dioxide concentrations to a doubling of the pre-industrial levels, which is really an ambitious target and something that currently, none of the proposed reductions for Kyoto or anything beyond that would come anywhere near that. So it's clear that accelerating this transition to hydrogen would achieve our climate goals much more successfully than any sort of UN agreement at this point. So there's a real opportunity in terms of climate stabilization, because you are talking about accelerating this natural decarbonization process that we've seen over the last 150 years, moving from as we've moved from wood to coal to oil to gas, we've increased the share of hydrogen atoms and reduced the share of carbon atoms, and so that decarbonization has been underway, but because of climate, there's a need to accelerate that. And using natural gas and hydrogen and ultimately using the hydrogen, using renewable energy to produce the hydrogen is seen as a real opportunity.
Moving on to a slightly different issue, in what ways is our current fossil fuel-based energy system vulnerable to terrorist attack?
Well, clearly the centralized nature. If you look at the electric power structure, the 20th century model, a very sort of large-scale centralized systems, it did have a lot of economic benefits up to a certain point, but the centralized nature of these plants also makes them vulnerable to attacks. More specifically, nuclear power plants pose a range of health safety risks, a number of which have come to light. Since the events of September 11th. And there are those that have argued that a more decentralized power system using fuel cells and solar and microturbines would provide much reduced vulnerability in that sense, to the extent that it's unlikely that terrorists would try to knock out a power line by targeting dozens of scattered systems. So that's one vulnerability. The other broader one, of course, is the oil import reliance. And the U.S. currently imports more than half of the oil that it uses. This is a problem that's prevalent, across the industrialized nations, but it's particularly pronounced for the U.S. because it consumes a quarter of the world total. And I think it's been a really educational process for Americans to sort of understand how that The oil reliance has factored into the military presence in Saudi Arabia, which in turn had been one of the grievances of the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And in turn, this need for Saudi oil has also complicated efforts to achieve reforms within the Saudi regime. So it's really, I think people are more aware now than they were a few months ago about the extent to which oil definitely can compromise American foreign policy objectives. And it's also led to a call, some calls for energy independence and reducing the need for oil imports, although there are different ways of doing that. Some say the answer is to get oil from other parts of the world. Others say that the answer is to reduce the need for oil in the first place. And I think if you were making the case for hydrogen, you would probably argue the latter and say the challenge is to, on one hand, limit our use by improving the efficiency of our highly inefficient vehicles, and then secondly, begin exploring the long-term alternative, which is hydrogen.
This is Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Seth Dunn, Research Associate at World Watch Institute. Our topic is moving from a fossil fuel to a hydrogen-based economy and the implications of the events of September 11th. How profoundly do you think the events of September 11th have changed our thinking about the value of hydrogen as a potential energy source? You've alluded to that a bit already, but let's hear more.
Well, I think, you know, more tangibly, I mean, first of all, there has certainly been more more media coverage. We've now seen some stories in Business Week and Fortune magazine, and that's really something you wouldn't have seen a few years ago when most coverage of hydrogen really was limited, and I'm talking about the print media, most of it was limited to scientific journals. So clearly, I think the commercial potential and the activity going on has caught a lot of attention, which is encouraging. That was happening before September 11th, but I think since then we've seen there are strategic opportunities there, not just for companies, but for governments in promoting this, in shifting toward hydrogen. Secondly, at the political level, there definitely has been an evolution. If, you know, at the beginning of the year, the debate within the Bush administration was, how much to cut the hydrogen budget. And the first, this is the research and development budget within the Department of Energy. And the original proposal was about a 50% cut. Now, that was restored later on in the process. But and in the actual national energy policy document, hydrogen was called an important fuel of the distant future, and not really given much else, much more coverage than that. Now, over the course of the summer, we saw a little bit more attention, some more discussion, and some legislation starting to move through that was going to give a little bit more funding to hydrogen, but really at an incremental level. Now, since then, we've seen Assistant Secretary David Garman testify earlier this fall in November, saying that the administration and DOE are now considering really redirecting and reevaluating their energy portfolio much more aggressively toward a hydrogen future, looking more at hydrogen and fuel cells, and it's acknowledging that certainly there are some investment risks in this new fuel and the new technologies, but the rewards, you know, in terms of oil import reliance and climate change, new businesses are certainly worth the investment. So that's a real evolution just over the last 10 or 11 months. It's hard to say, you know, where it'll end up. We don't know where our legislation will go. And, you know, interest may subside. But I think there is real momentum. And I think U.S. policymakers are aware that, you know, the rest of the world is moving toward hydrogen at different stages, and there may be advantages in getting there sooner.
Do you think that the attitude of industry has changed as a result of September 11th?
That's difficult to say. I think for all of them, they've all seen that they need to be involved in this business if they want to be in their own, the energy or the automobile business in the long term. They see that these technologies are coming, that they may not agree on how fast. It's harder to say whether the recent events have made them more aggressive in terms of their strategy. I think they certainly need to and acknowledge that they may have to prepare for a greater policy push toward hydrogen and fuel cells, and they may be adjusting. But again, that's really an uncertainty. We don't know how exactly the U.S. will respond in terms of its energy policy, whether it will give more attention to hydrogen at this point. But I think it's certainly something they'll have to, they're probably more aware of now. given current events.
How do we currently stand here in the U.S. on developing an infrastructure for hydrogen?
At a very, very early stage, and probably the best place to look right now would be in California, where there's a partnership based in Sacramento that's going to be testing out 50 buses and 20 cars over the next several years. And this is a partnership that involves really all of the world's major players, major car companies, fuel companies, and hydrogen suppliers, fuel cell companies, and government agencies, state agencies as well, or federal and state government agencies. So it's a really unique partnership, and they're all headquartered there, and they all have their offices right next to each other, and their proprietary technology is being tested out side by side, which is really sort of an interesting setup for such a competitive industry. And what they are doing there is testing out hydrogen fueling stations and looking at that whole process, as well as testing cars out to see how they handle the different climates of California. And so the challenge there is to sort of start figuring out this figuring out a roadmap. You know, what are the infrastructure needs? How many fueling stations would you need, depending on what kind of fuel is used in the car? So they're really scoping that out. And a recent study that was just finished for them concluded that probably the first vehicles will actually use hydrogen, while later ones may actually use methanol or gasoline if it's determined that the hydrogen, the vehicles using hydrogen directly aren't ready for commercial use yet. So it'll be an interesting thing to follow. But I think, you know, the biggest challenge is to figure out how to make that initial investment. And there's a need really for governments to step in and cover some of that risk.
How much will it cost to build a hydrogen infrastructure?
This is a really important question, yet one that really hasn't been answered that satisfactorily to many people. Some original numbers that were thrown out a few years ago were $100 billion just in the United States alone. However, those numbers have been questioned as being unreliable or unrealistic, suggesting that you really shouldn't be looking at how much it would cost to suddenly, all at once, build a full-blown network of pipelines and stations for hydrogen. Rather, it's better to look at what initial investments are needed to start building up, a small fleet of stations an infrastructure to support a small fleet, and you can build that infrastructure up over time as the fleet grows. And those numbers end up being much smaller, such as like $10 billion or even smaller for some other countries, according to some researchers at BP and Shell. So I think you know, even the industry itself recognizes that it may not cost as much as they originally thought. But I think probably the best answer to your question is that we really don't know. However, we do know that oftentimes these kinds of costs do tend to be overestimated in the early going, and it'll depend on a lot of variables, such as when we start mass producing the vehicles, how successful we are with putting up these first fueling stations. But I think the important thing is not to get paralyzed by the cost, and to use that or to misread it and conclude from those high numbers that the best thing to do would be to stick with a gasoline-based infrastructure. And I think the events of September, I think, point out that even if we do move toward hydrogen, but if we rely primarily on gasoline for the foreseeable future, that really won't do so much in terms of hedging our risks, hedging against the risks of oil import reliance. So that's another, you know, factor that may tilt the scale a little bit more toward the more aggressive pathway to directly using hydrogen.
How does the support for using hydrogen as a fuel in the U.S. compare with other countries?
It is not, I think, compared to other industrial nations, it's probably, and particularly with respect to its own, the potential and the resources in the U.S., it's quite limited, quite modest. If you compare, I think, you know, the largest and most sort of ambitious program is within Japan, where they're planning to spend $4 billion over the next 20 years through a program called WENET, or the World Energy Network. And so Japanese government has taken a much longer-term view of hydrogen, whereas here in the U.S., I think support, as with renewable energy, support for hydrogen has sort of waxed and waned with oil prices. And there was interest in the 80s and even before then in hydrogen, but it sort of disappeared as oil prices came back down, and the need to move beyond petroleum was perceived as not as urgent as before. And in Europe, there are demonstration projects have been underway for quite some time in Germany and other areas, and there's a real interest there. And that's they're going to be about 30 buses will be tested out in 9 cities over the next several years, in including Reykjavik, Iceland, but also a number of cities on the continent. And so clearly, there's an interest in also moving at an industry wide or EU wide level toward hydrogen. And I would say in both cases with Europe and Japan, there's been a good deal of government industry cooperation on this issue. And I think that'll be one of the challenges within the U.S., which often has had sort of antagonistic relationships between the government and industry in many different areas. So I think the challenge will be to try to figure out how do these kinds of partnerships work, where you figure out the role for government and the role for industry and how they can both make this happen. And I should add, however, that reportedly the U.S. government is now sitting down with members of industry, General Motors and some other companies, to do exactly that and to try to figure out a roadmap toward hydrogen. And that is expected to come out sometime next spring.
What do you think are the most important changes in public policy that should be made?
Well, I think, there are a whole suite of things, because this is such a profound shift and revolutionary shift. It's hard to single out one or two, but I think a number certainly deserve top priority. I think continued support for research and development in some of the key long-term areas, like improving the efficiency of fuel cells, improving new storage technologies, improving electrolysis from renewable energy. I think those are really key. And so looking at what technologies would have to be really far along so that 50 years out we would be where we want to be, I think that's really critical. And that long-term R&D needs to be supported by government, not entirely, but, cooperating with industry. I think doing feasibility studies, like just, getting consultants in and mapping out, for countries or for states or for provinces, what would it mean? How could this country or whatever it is, could this entity move toward hydrogen? What are the economic potential benefits? What are the costs? And those have proven useful in places like Norway and Iceland as well. So getting that scientific base is really important in mapping out what the potential opportunities, because once those opportunities can be quantified, I think it's easier to move policymakers forward. A whole range of, energy pricing, of course. At some point, I think the U.S. and other countries will have to really confront the fact that we don't really see the real price of energy, and we'll have to figure out a way in that direction. But I think in the near term, you'll probably see more likely tax incentives for people who buy these cars in the first place. And one other thing I would add is, public education. I mean, it's easy to be sort of ensconced in this debate among government officials and industry, and then you suddenly step outside and realize that there really is limited awareness and understanding of hydrogen. And I think that's really a problem, and there does need to be a lot more awareness so that people can be reminded and told of what the benefits are, what the potential costs are, because without much stronger support at a public level, you aren't really going to get aggressive public policies.
What would you list as the main obstacles in moving towards a hydrogen economy?
Well, I think probably three. I mean, first of all, improving, making fuel cells more efficient, improving, bringing the cost down, which can ultimately be overcome through mass production. Secondly, improving the storage of hydrogen so that the onboard storage of hydrogen is feasible, and so we can avoid getting locked into, I think, what's really inferior approach of using gasoline or methanol reformers. And then finally, I think resolving this infrastructure issue that we discussed earlier and figuring out pragmatic ways to start developing an infrastructure and not getting bogged down in specific cost debates and really starting to just get on the ground and start figuring out who needs to do what and road mapping. So I think that really, and that's the government, I think the challenge is really for government industry to sort of map out who's doing what and not assuming that the other needs to play the major role. Because one of the things I've noticed in doing my research is that oftentimes you hear government say, well, industry really has to implement all of this. And then industry says, well, government really has to come in and set the environment for us to move toward hydrogen. And so there's a real danger of sort of an institutional chicken and an egg. And so I think there's going to be there's a real need to kind of focus attention in places like Iceland and California and begin asking what's happening and start to really apply pressure. And finally, you know, again, back to public support, you know, moving hydrogen up the energy, sort of the food chain among energy sources. It's still quite low. It's down with the plankton, but it's moving up. And I think there'll be a challenge in sorting out the trade-offs because currently, you know, most of the supports, you know, that have been proposed over the last year really are designed to sort of maintain the incumbent hydrocarbon-based system. And so that's a huge, that's one of the biggest challenges, is overcoming those sort of entrenched market rules.
Looking from the other point of view, what forces do you see that are encouraging or pushing us towards a hydrogen economy most strongly?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, first of all, there are these macro trends like, you know, climate change, energy security, urban air pollution, which is another thing we haven't really talked about, but that really has sort of been a big driver in California and is also a big factor in some of the testings of fuel cell buses that we're going to see in China and Brazil and Mexico over the next few years. But I would add, in addition to those factors, which will vary, of course, from, you know, different parts of the world, I think the competitive dynamic that's underway is encouraging. And the fact that companies like General Motors are making major investments in companies, in hydrogen-based companies, and they're developing their own types of fuel cells. So I think the level of corporate activity in this area and signs of a real serious effort, and the entry of new players, so it's not just Shell and BP, but it's Texaco, Chevron, Texaco, the fact that you see hydrogen mentioned in some of these, in the ads of Toyota and Chevron, Texaco, and others. So clearly they're, you know, and one might dismiss that as merely as greenwashing, but I think beneath that there is a real corporate move in that direction. I would add that I don't think this development will unfold at a rate that's sufficient for dealing with these problems by market forces alone. I think there does definitely need to be a catalytic role for government. But I would add that, you know, this competitive dynamic is underway. Investments are really climbing in this new energy technology area. So I think that's encouraging. There's a lot of activity, and hydrogen conferences themselves are becoming more like trade shows. They're not just scientists and engineers sitting around debating papers. There are companies out there showing their products. It's a lot of excitement. So, you know, the American entrepreneurship is there, even if the U.S. policy isn't as progressive as it could be.
Well, we're almost out of time, but just very briefly, what is the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think, you know, this is an opportunity to sort of think long-term about where, you know, our energy system should be headed in next 50 to 100 years. I think, you know, that some of the choices we make now will have huge implications. And clearly, you know, the hydrogen has an enormous potential to not solve all of our environmental problems, but it can hedge against oil import, security problems, climate change, urban air pollution. So it really presents a lot of opportunities and also a lot of business opportunities for the U.S. So there's a competitiveness issue as well. And I think just as, you know, this is part of an historical process, we've had to make transitions in the past, whether it was Winston Churchill shifting his navy from coal to oil earlier last century. I think it's a strategic interest for the U.S. to do this. And if it doesn't, I think it'll suffer ultimately, both environmentally and economically. But ultimately, I think it's an exciting opportunity. But I think there's a much greater need for public debate about what are the costs and risks of moving in that direction, but also what are the costs and risks of staying where we are and keeping on sort of a business-as-usual trajectory.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Seth Dunn, Research Associate at World Watch Institute. For more information, check on the web at www.worldwatch.org. Again, that's www.worldwatch.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week.